This is Silver Star Bible School, 1992, Day 4, Session 3. Our speaker is our brother Jim Cowie, and his subject is, "Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to Him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come." And today's subtitle is, "A New Heaven and a New Earth." Our reading is Revelation 21, verses 1 to 8. Brother Jim.
Brothers and sisters, there's something highly appropriate, isn't there, about the fact that there are some of our number who are still in town because of a funeral, while the rest of us are here on the mountaintop to consider that one portion of the scripture which speaks so magnificently about the end of death. There shall be no more tears, no more crying, no more sorrow, because there shall be no death. And we have come on this day of all days, brethren and sisters, to consider 8 verses which are unique in Scripture, because they speak of that time beyond the millennium when there will be no more death. No one will die, least of all our brethren. Isn't that very appropriate? I didn't organise that, but here we are. We've come to what I believe is a unique piece of scripture. And I want you to see it very plainly in its context before we proceed. We need to go back, as you will recall, to the 11th verse of chapter 20. But in case in the rush of things I forget, we want to just deal with the overall structure of these chapters before us. Because in coming to verse 1 of chapter 21, we've come to the final vision of the apocalypse. It is the last vision. It can be broken up into 2 or 3 sections. And we've been led there progressively through chapter 19. You'll remember that's the chapter that deals with the conquest of the nations and the abolition of the harlot system by the one who rides upon a white horse with his army that follows him in heaven. And we saw the result of that. 40 years of conquest brought the binding of the old serpent, the dragon power, the devil and Satan, for 1,000 years. Then at the end of the 1,000 years, there's a rebellion. It is ruthlessly suppressed. Then there's a second resurrection and a second judgment, which we shall consider shortly. And the end result of that, brethren and sisters, verses 1 to 8 of chapter 21. And there it sits in the record, unique, because you see, when you consider these 8 verses before us this afternoon, in their rightful context, they're way out here. You see that? We're way out here, beyond mortality. We're into the 8th millennium, when God is all and in all. We're in that period where there is no more sin. And there's no more death. It's that period of time upon which we should set our hope. How often do we quote, brothers and sisters, the words of Numbers 14:21? "As truly as I live," he means eternally. He's using his immortality as the guarantee. "As truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with my glory." And that will not be true until we're beyond the millennium, because there will be death. There will be a rebellion. You see, that's the time we should be focusing on, brethren and sisters. I know it's hard enough for our finite minds even to drag ourselves into the millennium, but that's not the period of time that we should focus on. As grand as that will be for you and me, as we pointed out yesterday, there will be a violent struggle with sin for 1,000 years in the lives over whom we have responsibility, the individuals for whom we have responsibility. There will be that violent struggle in them, and we will watch that sometimes with joy and sometimes with sadness. And there will still be crying and tears and death. Just read Isaiah 66 and the last 2 verses of that glorious prophecy, and you'll read that the worshippers who come to the house of prayer for all nations will go home having seen a pile of dead bodies, where their worm dieth not, and the fire never goes out because it's consuming the flesh of dead bodies that are cast upon that heap in the western wall. And they shall be an abhorring unto all flesh. Oh yes, there'll still be death. But beyond the millennium, brethren and sisters, when the glory of God covers the earth, as the waters cover the sea, and every single creature is affected by that, then we've got the perfection for which we seek. Then the righteousness of our God is totally vindicated. Then there is an end of every challenge to purity and holiness. Then and only then can there be rest. Here we are in verses 1 to 8 of Revelation 21. When there is no more sea, no more nations, no more mortality. So you see, it's quite a unique session, this one, because of the uniqueness of the subject. But what happens in Revelation 21 is that in verses 1 to 8, we've got that vision that takes us beyond the millennium. But then, as is typical in the apocalypse, the following verses, from verse 9 of chapter 21 through to verse 6 of chapter 22, complete that vision by going back to the start, so to speak, to show how these things are developed. How it is that there is the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven in verse 2. And so that subject is developed. It's the development of the house that Yahweh promised to David. It's the development of the great nation that he promised to Abraham. So we shall see the completion of those two covenants as we consider very carefully Revelation 21 and 22. There's another division, perhaps, at the beginning of chapter 22. We have the throne, and out of that throne there's a river of life, which focuses in particular upon the way or the means by which these things are accomplished. It's a reference to the power of the Spirit, and we shall be spending, God willing, tomorrow some time on that subject. So there's our final vision. And then, of course, from verse 7 of chapter 22 to the end of the chapter, we have the final message of our Lord, his final exhortation. And brethren and sisters, we can expect when we come to that final exhortation that we will get it straight from the shoulder. There won't be any pulling of punches. You would expect the Lord, wouldn't you, to give us exactly, precisely the message we need. And that's exactly what he does. Like Paul to the Ephesians in Acts 20, he does not waste any words. And his warning is one that if we ignore it, well, of course, we've only got ourselves to blame if we're not here to enjoy the things that we shall consider today. So we'll come to that in due course, God willing. We need now to go back to verse 11 of chapter 20. And that passage presents to us a picture. Best we can illustrate it, and this is not my drawing, courtesy of my brother, who's about as good an artist as I am. At best, we can illustrate it. Here is the vision of Revelation 20 in verse 11. And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it. It's a white throne. We don't need to argue about that, do we, as to what the whiteness represents. We've got chapter 19, verse 8. We've got chapter 19, verse 11. Chapter 19, verse 14. White garments, white horse, now a white throne. It's righteousness, isn't it, the dominant feature? Here's a throne, a great throne of righteousness. And why shouldn't it be that? Because the one who sits there is the Melchizedek, king of righteousness. He's the one who possessed the righteousness that put him on that throne. And now he's going to decide who will go with him beyond the seventh millennium. He's the judge. He's the king who sits upon that throne. So here it is, a great white throne. Now the interesting thing about this, brethren and sisters, is that this deals, as Brother Roberts quite rightly says in the 13 lectures, with the second judgment seat at the end of the millennium. It's not the first judgment seat, but it may as well be, because the second judgment seat is the same as the first in its pattern and its order. and the process by which those who are responsible are judged. So you and I can't just sit here this afternoon and look upon these things with some detachment. Because we, if we're there at that second judgment, and we've got a great work to do if we are, if we're there at that judgment, we will have gone through exactly the same process as the people that stand there in that day. Exactly the same process. So here we are before the great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away. Now, there we are introduced to the subject of verse 1 of chapter 21. For the earth and the heaven he refers to here in verse 11 is the second Israelitish heavens, or the government of the millennial age. That is the constitution of the millennial age. So at the end of the 1,000 years, the time comes for that heavens and earth that has existed for a millennium to pass away and to be replaced by a new heavens and a new earth. As we read in chapter 21, verse 1, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. That new heaven and new earth in verse 1 is the third Israelitish heavens. It is the third time that Israel has had its kingdom established in the earth. There was an ancient kingdom. Then there is going to be the millennial kingdom of Israel. But beyond that, there will be a third Israelitish heavens, different in constitution to the first and to the second. So here is the one who is going to go through the processes that lead to the abolition of this second heavens. So from his face, the earth and the heaven flee away, and there was found no place for them. In other words, that constitution, which will see a combination of immortality, that is in the saints, and mortality, that is in the general population both of Israel and the nations, is going to be abolished. And beyond that, there is going to be a new constitution in which everybody is immortal. It's a new heavens and a new earth. So this is the process that brings it to pass, this great white throne. And I saw the dead, he says in verse 12, small and great, because you see, in that day, brothers and sisters, it will be necessary to raise all the dead who have died during the millennium, because they will all have known the truth, every one of them. So there will be a universal resurrection. And they stand before God, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. So there are two kinds of books here, aren't there? Ever noticed that before? That's because, you see, as it is with us, so it is with them. That there are two books involved in the process of judgment. One is a book that is an individual account of our daily lives, which we might call a book of the life, a record of the life. That's the books, plural there, you see, in the third line of verse 12. There's one for each individual. Now, you could argue all day about whether they're literal books or figurative books. I happen to believe they're literal, but that's just my opinion, and my small mind thinks that's a better way to go. But it doesn't matter. What does matter is that there is a record of the individual life, and this verse proves it. The other book is one we know well. It's called the Book of Life. And that's a book in which is recorded the names of all the redeemed. When we're baptized, our name is written in that book. At the end of our probation, the name is either left there or it's scrubbed out. In the case of Israel in the wilderness, it took 2 years and it was scrubbed out. They're dead, said the Lord in John chapter 6. Your fathers ate manna and they're dead. Their name was scrubbed out. But it doesn't record the things that they did. And we read in verse 12, and the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books. Notice that? The things that were written in the books. What was written in the books? Just read on. according to their works. So their works were recorded in the books. Now, who do you think might write the record? Well, I'll make a suggestion to you, brothers and sisters. You will. Because in the millennial age, you will be as the angels of today. And God has not given unto the angels the administration of the kingdom age. He's given that to you and me. And we will do what the angels are doing today. And what are they doing? Well, have a look at this. You don't need to turn this up. Just consider Malachi 3:16, which we know very well. Then they that feared Yahweh spake often one to another. And Yahweh hearkened and heard it. And a book of remembrance was written before him. He didn't write it. Others wrote it in his presence, as the word before means. A book of remembrance was written in his presence. Because you see, it was the practice of ancient monarchs, as Esther chapter 6 and verse 1 records, to write down the history of their rule. And hence, when the king could not sleep one night, you'll remember, he brought out the records of the kingdom. They brought out some books. And he was reading through one of those records that had been written in his presence some years before. And he read concerning the work of Mordecai the Jew, who had saved him from assassination. And he said, what's been done to Mordecai? Of course, nothing had been done, and we know the rest of the story. So Mordecai's works had been recorded in the presence of the king. And this is picked up in Malachi 3, and Yahweh says, I will record the deeds, the works of those that fear my name. Those that feared Yahweh and thought upon his name. The word thought there, chashab, means to plait or to weave, to compute by mental effort. In other words, to work into your lives the principles of the name. To bring into our lives the characteristics of our Father in the things that we do. He kept a record of that, brethren and sisters, and it was written in his presence. Who do you think might have written that? The angels. They're the recorders. And who better? Because you see, he sends them forth to minister to those who shall be heirs of salvation. Hebrews 1:14. And Jacob recognized that. The angel which has been with me all the days of my life. Keep the lads. Bless the lads. He knew the angel was there. Who better to record the life of the individual? And you think about this. Yeah, we sit here in Bible schools and we open the Bible at Kings and Chronicles and Samuel and we read about men and women of faith and otherwise. And we study their lives with great precision. We're doing that with the ecclesias, the seven ecclesias. We're considering their ecclesial history. Do you think that they all knew that the record was kept? Do you think that the kings of Judah or of Israel who have gone down in this record as having acts, the acts of the king, were this first and last which determined their destiny? Do you think they know that that record was kept? Most of them don't. When they pop out of that ground, brothers and sisters, and you and I go to them and say, listen here, I know all about you and your character. Glad to meet you. They'll be bewildered. How do you know about me? Someone wrote a book about you. And it may well be that there'll be some more books in the kingdom age about you and me. Ever thought about that? The books were opened, and the dead were judged out of the things that were written in the books. To see whether or not their name was in the book of life or otherwise. Brethren and sisters, we need, I think, to think carefully about that. It's sobering, I know. I'm sorry. But it's there. And the other sobering fact is this, that when this verse is fulfilled, it'll be you and me that open the books. And we'll do precisely with those people who have been raised from the dead to appear at the judgment seat, as the angels will shortly do with you and me. Open the record and review the life and go through it to see what the characteristics of that individual were, what it was that was motivating them, what it was that was at the base of their lives. That's the principle of that. So we read on, verse 13. That the sea gave up the dead that were in it. The sea is a symbol of the nations, isn't it? Death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them. Universal resurrection, because all will be responsible. And they were judged, every man, according to their works. Even in the kingdom age, according to their works. Now you would think, wouldn't you, in a perfect ecclesial environment, where everybody's in the truth, it doesn't matter which house you go to. It's the Christadelphian house. You would think, wouldn't you, that that would be an ideal place for people to manifest their works. I'll tell you something, brethren and sisters. I know some very strong ecclesias on the surface. I know some very large ecclesias who have a name that they live. But I can find you a lot of people in there who are not doing any works of the kind that the Lord is seeking. Because I happen to know what they're doing. And it ain't the kind of works that he's looking for. Because you see, it's an armchair ride. It's too easy. Don't ever imagine that being in a good environment is going to create works. It's the other way around. So these people are judged on their works, which means they've got to make a conscious choice to weave into their lives the characteristics of God. You and I will help them to do that. Or she'll be a voice behind them, says Isaiah 30. Your eyes will see your teachers, but there will be those times when you don't see your teachers, he says in Isaiah 30, but you'll hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way. Walk ye in it. Wouldn't be bad to have a voice like that behind us sometimes, would it? So here we are. Verse 14, death and hell were cast into the lake of fire at the result of this judgment process. Death and the grave. You can only abolish death if there's no sin. You can only abolish the grave if there's no death. So the last enemy is destroyed. Why? Because there's no sin. And there's no sin because the serpent's dead. Then it says in the last sentence of verse 14, this is the second death. And this is the second occurrence of that phrase. The third one's in verse 8 of chapter 21. The last two lines. Which is the second death. And you need to make the connection between verses 14 and 15 of chapter 20 and verse 8 of chapter 21. Because verse 15 says, and whosoever was not found written in the book of life, that is the book which records names, was cast into the lake of fire. When you read verse 8 of chapter 21, it says, but this is the class that are not in the book of life. The fearful, the word means cowards. The unbelieving, that means faithless. The abominable, that means the disgusting. And the murderers, that means those who hate their brethren. And the whoremongers, that means those who consort with the harlot system. And the sorcerers, that word pharmakias means witchcraft. It has the idea of issuing drugs. Those who feed drugs that put brethren to sleep. And idolaters, that means those who are like Lot's wife, covetous. And all, look at the last class, who are they? And all liars, that means errorists. And who was their father? John 8:44. I know who your father is, he said to the Pharisees. I know who he is. He was a liar from the beginning. And the father of a lie. You know who he is? The old serpent. That's who he was. He's the one, the first liar. And he taught wrong doctrine. He didn't think he was teaching wrong doctrine, but he did teach wrong doctrine. And that's where it all came from, brothers and sisters. And they're the last ones to be destroyed. You see that? And they shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Irretrievable oblivion. Genesis 3:15. fulfilled. Sorry for waking you up. But that's exciting, brothers and sisters, is it not? It's exciting. Genesis 3:15 is fulfilled. And the serpent's head is crushed. And the first great covenant is complete.
Now for the second one.
Verse 1 of Revelation 21. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. And there was no more sea. There were no more Gentile nations. That's what the sea represents, doesn't it? Isaiah 57:20, Isaiah 17, verse 12. You know the references as well as I do. The sea represents the nations. There's no more nations. Why? Because there's no more mortality. But more than that, brethren and sisters, now on the earth there is only one nation, one corporation. That's all that's left, just one nation. And every living soul is immortal, and they're part of that one nation. And here is the great beauty of what is before us, because it's speaking about the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise. You see, when he says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, as I said, this is the introduction of a totally new order of things in which there is no mortal beings. It's a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven, that is the millennial heavens, were passed away. And there was no more mortal nations. But what did he see? And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven. New Jerusalem. What's that represent, brethren and sisters? Well, we shall see in a minute that it represents that spiritual corporation, which we know as the Ecclesia, in its perfected state, in which every living soul is a member forevermore. It's talking about the Abrahamic corporation. But before we launch into that, brethren and sisters, I think perhaps we should just pick up some of the ideas that flow through from chapter 20 into 21. I know this might, in terms of verse by verse, not be quite as smooth flowing. But I want you to see that what we are introduced to in verses 1 and 3, 1 to 3 of chapter 21 is the result of the abolition of mortality and the total dominion of the Spirit over mortality. And to do that, we need just to press on a bit further into the context. Verse 4 says, God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, sorrow, crying, etc. Verse 5, and he that sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. He said to me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. I make all things new. Where does that phrase come from? Someone will say Psalm 8. And they're right. But it's repeated. Have a look down in verse 7. He that overcometh shall inherit all things. And I will be his God, and he shall be my son. Now you'll see that that's based, it's a development of verse 3. They shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. Which means that they're all immortal. There is no diffidence for the Father to actually be with men. Now I know that the term God there represents Yahweh manifested in Christ. I'm not unaware of that. Why, back in verse 12 of chapter 20, it says they stand before God, that's Christ, as Yahweh's manifestation. I'm aware of that, brothers and sisters. I'm also aware that the Lord himself said that the pure in heart shall see God. And I personally believe that when all sin and mortality has been removed and the last enemy is destroyed, that the Father himself will have no diffidence to visit the earth. Now that's a staggering thought. But why should we have difficulty with it? For we are the angels of that age. And when this is fulfilled, everybody will be as the angels. And they behold the Father's face in heaven. So why should that be a difficulty? But it's a staggering thought, isn't it? You see, brothers and sisters, this is a fulfillment of Psalm 8. That's why you've got in verse 7, again that phrase, all things. Now Psalm 8 is a beautiful psalm. Can I just rely upon your memories? O Yahweh, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. You know, I hear that quoted sometimes of today. I shudder, I shudder. Is Yahweh's name excellent in all the earth today, brothers and sisters? The psalm begins and ends with those words. His name will only be majestic in all the earth when there is dominion over all things by one who's titled in that psalm in verse 4, the Son of Man, because that's his title of delegated authority to exercise dominion over carnal things, to do what the first Adam could not do. So he's come along and he's taken over. He's had dominion over carnal things in himself first. He destroyed the serpent in himself first. Then progressively through the millennium, he will crush the serpent power until finally it's destroyed and he's got dominion over all things. That's why it says that here, every living creature, verse 7, that goes beyond the millennium will exercise the same dominion. He that overcometh shall inherit all things. They will exercise that dominion over carnality which will have been destroyed. And that's why it then adds in verse 7, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. There will be consubstantiality, as the doctor puts it, between the Father and all his creation. It's a marvellous thing, isn't it? But it only comes about by the dominion that is exercised over carnality by the Spirit. Now that's your work and my work in the kingdom age. But we won't be there unless we're actively, of course, involved in that process now. In the 1 Corinthians 15, which is the other context that deals with this era, the apostle has something interesting to say. Most of you, of course, are totally familiar with 1 Corinthians 15 and verses 24 to 28. It's a little context in itself, isn't it? Just those few verses. The result of the resurrection process and then the subjugation finally of death. The last enemy. Verse 24 of 1 Corinthians 15, we read this. Then cometh the end, when he shall have, you see it's past, he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power. Could I suggest to you, this is an exercise for the moment, that you count the alls that are in this passage? Just for those of you who want to know certainly, with some certainty I should say, that I'm getting this right, the word all is the Greek word pas, and it's consistently translated all throughout this passage between verse 24 and 28. There's no other word pas in that text. You just count them. I don't think they're being repeated for no reason. When he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power, for he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. You see, this is being drawn from Psalm 8, isn't it? The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. For he hath put all things under his feet. That's a quotation from Psalm 8. Psalm 8 is an exposition of Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 to 28. Let them have dominion. Guess what the word dominion means? Tread underfoot. Let them have dominion. Who's going to have the dominion? Well, the man, as he's described, and his bride. The Son of Man and his bride. Let them have dominion. But when he saith all things are put under him, it is manifest that he has accepted, which did put all things under him. And when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall a son also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all and in all. How many alls are there? 10. Which is the number of ordinal perfection. That's it. The lot. Guess what? There's another dominant word there, isn't there? It's the word under. The word subdued. The word subject. In fact, there are two Greek words rendered under and subdued and subject, but both of them have the word hupo in them. There's the word hupo itself, it stands alone. It's the word under. And there's the word hupotasso. But the word hupo, brothers and sisters, occurs in the context here between verses 24 and 28 eight times. And eight is the number of immortality. We're talking about the eighth millennium, when God is all and in all because all are immortal. Eight to the Hebrew was a new beginning. Complete cycle. Seven, start again. Immortality. So here we've got a context which even in the use of the words indicates that all ten are immortal. Eight. You reckon that's by design? And that's the only other place that I know of, at least in the New Testament, apart from the reference to the third heavens in 2 Corinthians 12, where we're taken beyond the millennium. Isn't that a remarkable context, brothers and sisters? And you can see the reasons. I haven't got time to explain it, but you can see the reasons, I think, why it is that the language of Psalm 8 is picked up here by Paul in Corinthians and by the Lord in the Apocalypse and fed into that context, because he's going right back to the beginning, to the original problem, which was that Adam adopted the thinking of one of the creatures over which he was to exercise dominion. So the Father raised up the second Adam and gave him the same nature in which was the serpent, carnal thinking, and he was able, by divine power and perfect obedience, to crush the head of the serpent. And he's doing that in you and me. And ultimately, when he's finished, brethren and sisters, the serpent power itself is destroyed utterly out of the earth. And all are immortal. Isn't that a marvelous program? When we come back to Revelation chapter 21, we can see the reason for this language. But now for the other aspect. The aspect of the Abrahamic promise, as it occurs here in Revelation 21 and 22. We read in verse 2 of chapter 21, "And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven." That is, there is immortality. Universal immortality. They've all been born of the Spirit. That's what it means. They come down from God out of heaven. They're all bearing his nature. It doesn't mean they physically come down from heaven. It means they're all like him. Prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. More about the bride aspect a little bit later on. But here you've got Christ and his bride presented before us. They're described as the holy city, the New Jerusalem. What's that city? Well, it's the Abrahamic city. You come with me to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. We read in verse 10 of Abraham and of his sons, Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs together with him of the same promise in verse 9. "For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God." Isn't that interesting language? He looked for a city. Now, he certainly wouldn't be looking for one of our cities, would he? The thing I dread is going back to a city after being on the mountain. He doesn't mean one of our cities. In fact, he left a city, Ur of the Chaldees. He wasn't looking for that kind of city. What kind of city was he looking for? Well, it's got foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Brethren and sisters, let me ask you a question. Do you think that that city is the ecclesia today? Or the ecclesia tomorrow in the millennial age? Because you see, it's not going to be complete, is it, until after the millennium? Do you think that God, the builder and the maker thereof, would be satisfied with an unfinished city? God always finishes what he starts. We don't. So it's not a reference to the city of the ecclesia today or of tomorrow. It's a reference to the spiritual corporation that will inhabit the earth after the millennium. Verse 16. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. An heavenly? Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God. This is the language of the apocalypse, isn't it? For he hath prepared for them a city. Yes, he has. A perfect city. A completed city. Because he's the builder and the maker thereof. And he will not rest. At least he personally might rest in the millennium. But he will not rest because he will work through his Son and through the saints until that city is complete. And in chapter 12 we read of that. Chapter 12 of Hebrews in verse 22 and 23. Where Paul contrasts two covenants, doesn't he? The old covenant, the Mosaic, with the new covenant, the Abrahamic. And it is, brethren and sisters, the Abrahamic covenant he's talking about. All you need to do is to read Hebrews very carefully and you'll see that the new covenant is not something new at all. It's the old covenant. That is the older covenant. The reason it's called a new covenant is it was ratified by blood last. But it existed 430 years before the law. So the new covenant is the Abrahamic covenant. Paul makes that very plain in Hebrews. Verse 22, in this contrast between covenants, he speaks of the Abrahamic in this way. But ye are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels. This is where the language of the apocalypse is coming from, isn't it? To the general assembly and ecclesia of the firstborns, that is, firstborns from the dead, which are written in heaven, because their names are in the book of life. And to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits or the characters of righteous men, made complete in immortality. That's the city we're associated with, brethren and sisters, and it will not be complete until mortality has been destroyed. So you see, it's an Abrahamic city. And the things of Abraham, the things of Israel are stamped all over it. You come back to Revelation 21. What's the number that characterizes this city? Well, from verse 9 onwards, of course, we've got the description, the development of this perfect city that comes down from God out of heaven. Look at the number that characterizes it in verse 12. It had a wall, great and high, and had 12 gates, and the names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. I missed the angels, didn't I, in that other line. They're the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. And have a look at the way that 12 pops out of the record. Verse 14, the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and in them the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Verse 16, it was 12,000 furlongs. Verse 17, the wall thereof was 144 cubits. That's 12 times 12. Verse 20, at the end of the verse, the 11th, the jacinth, the 12th, an amethyst. Verse 21, and the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Verse 2 of chapter 22, in the middle of the verse, it bare 12 manner of fruits. It's just an interesting fact, brethren and sisters, that there are 10 occurrences of the word 12. And if you add the 2 for the 144, that is 12 times 12, there are 12 occurrences of the word 12. Guess how many occurrences of the word city in this last vision? You got it right. There are 12. And what do you think of when you think of 12? Revelation 7, the perfected ecclesia, set forth as 144,000. There were 12,000 in this tribe and 12,000 in that tribe. 12,000 in that tribe. They're the perfected Israel, aren't they? That's why at the end of verse 12 it says, of the children of Israel. So what is the holy city? What is the new Jerusalem, brothers and sisters? It is the perfected Israel of God. That's what it is. The perfect Israel. And it's the only nation left on earth. There's no more sea. There's just one nation. And the hope of Israel is fulfilled. And of his kingdom there shall be no end. What does it mean in time? Because we know Christ's kingdom does end. He hands his kingdom, the kingdom, back to God. So his kingdom does end. It only lasts for 1,000 years. That's what it says in chapter 20. They lived and reigned with him for 1,000 years. He doesn't reign beyond 1,000 years, but the kingdom goes on forever. But in that 1,000 years, brothers and sisters, his kingdom has no end. And what that means is that you can go anywhere on earth, to the ends of the earth, even to Australia, and you'll be in his kingdom. That's what that means. What proof of that? Read Isaiah 9, 6 and 7. Of the progress of his zeal and power, of the increase of his government, there shall be no end. How do you increase government? You raise the taxes? Or you take more territory? Got the idea of that? Of his kingdom, there shall be no end. And when he's finished and the nations are abolished, for their lives are prolonged for a season and a time, Daniel chapter 7. When he's finished with them, he's got one nation left, and it's called Israel. Galatians 6:16. Revelation 21. It's called Israel in fulfillment of two prophecies. Jeremiah 30, verse 11. Fear not, O Jacob. Fear not, Israel. For though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, I will not make a full end of thee. You'll go on forever. And the other prophecy, way back in Genesis chapter 12, verses 2 and 3. Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation. Did he mean the nation under Joshua, which fell apart in the time of the judges? Did he mean the kingdom of David and Solomon, which fell apart under Jeroboam and Rehoboam and others? Did he mean Israel and the kingdom age, brothers and sisters, the head of the nation? No. He didn't mean that at all. He was talking about this nation. The one nation that is left on earth from the 8th millennium on. I will make of thee a great nation. Proof? That's the first of seven clauses in the first of seven promises that God made to Abraham. You know what the seventh clause was? In thee, Abraham, shall all families of the earth be blessed. He gives six more. He gets to the end of seven promises. And the last thing he says, in your seed, Abraham, shall all the families of the earth be blessed. How will they be blessed? They'll all be members of the great nation. Fulfillment, Abrahamic promise. That's number two. You and I are going to be there. Verse 3 of Revelation 21. I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. He will dwell with them. They shall be his people. God himself shall be with them and be their God. Why, brothers and sisters, did Yahweh command his people when they came out of Egypt to dwell in tabernacles in the wilderness? on the 15th day of the seventh month for 7 days. And we're told in the scripture the reason for it. The reason was that they could dwell in a building that hath foundations. You want to look up the passages that speak of dwelling in a booth through the Psalms. It talks about dwelling upon a rock. The reason he said, you take an axe and cut down the branches of trees and make a flimsy shelter, is that he was trying to teach them the principle not to put trust in the works of their own hands, but to make him their foundation. And when they dwelt in those booths, brothers and sisters, out in the wilderness or on the sides of the hills around Jerusalem for 7 days, the entire family of Israel was there depending upon their God, and they had foundations. But here we read, the tabernacle of God is with men. And there's a reason why it says in Zechariah 14, verse 16, that the nations in the kingdom age will keep the feast of tabernacles. They're going to learn to dwell with God, that he might dwell with them. You know what, brothers and sisters? When the nations sit under their branches in the kingdom age, they'll be thinking about what Israel used to do in ancient times. When Israel kept the Feast of Tabernacles, in the course of a week, they offered up 70 bullocks. On day one, they offered 13, because that's the number of rebellion, where God had to start with human rebellion. And it was the rebellion that brought about the division of the family of man into 70 nations. So he starts with 13. And he works his way down. On day two, they offered 12 bullocks. On day three, it was 11. Four, it was 10. Five, it was 9. Day six, it was 8. And on day seven, appropriately, because that matches the millennium, it was 7, which is peculiarly the number of the Abrahamic covenant. And when the nations sit under their vine and fig tree, under the branches, in the Feast of Tabernacles, I'll be thinking about that. What's God doing with us? He's incorporating us into his family, the family of Israel, isn't he? We've all got to be members of one nation. Isn't that what he's doing? Through the Abrahamic promises? Isn't that where he's heading? Oh yes, it is, brethren and sisters, because there was an 8th day. There was an 8th day of the feast, the last holy convocation in Israel's religious year. The last major thing they did was only the 7th month, 5 months to go. The 8th day wasn't actually attached to the Feast of Tabernacles. It was separate. You know what it's called in John chapter 7 and verse 37? That great day of the feast. It was a great day. It's the 8th day. It's the time beyond the millennium. And guess how many bullocks Israel offered on the 8th day? 1. Just 1. And the 70 nations that were formed by the rebellion of Nimrod, who developed the Catholic harlot system that Christ and the saints have destroyed, have now all been brought back into one nation that was formed by God plucking one man from the very heart of Babylon's mysteries and working in him to develop a great nation. And we're looking at it. The holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven. You know what, brothers and sisters? The word is a remarkable thing. And if our interpretations are correct, then the scriptures speak for themselves, don't they? Now, this morning, Brother Alan took us to Isaiah chapter 41. I want you to come back. No, don't, sir, please. Don't go there quite just yet. I haven't prepared your mind sufficiently. That's where we'll end up. Just come down to verse 6. Verse 5, perhaps. Revelation 21. He says, "Behold, I make all things new." He said to me, "Write, for these words are true and faithful." This is the true realities. He said unto me, "It is done." Now, some of you with good memories from this morning will immediately see where we're going. "It is done." That's the language of Isaiah 41:4. "I am the Alpha." It's the first letter of the alphabet. Stands as number one. That's its number. Numerical value of Alpha? One. "And the Omega." That's the last letter of the alphabet. By the time you get to Omega, you've got all the rest. You've got one, and then you've got a multitude. "I will give to him that is athirst to the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son." He'll be a member of that one nation. You come back to Isaiah 41 now. What's Isaiah 41 about? It's about Cyrus, isn't it? "Keep silence," verse 1, "before me, O islands, coastlands. Let the people renew their strength. Let them come near. Then let them speak. Let us come near together to judgment. Who raised up one from the east?" As it should read. "In righteousness called him to his foot." It's a reference to Cyrus. "Gave the nations before him and made him rule over kings. Gave him as the dust to his sword and as driven stubble to his bow. He pursued them and passed safely even by the way that he had not gone with his feet." Who did that? Well, it was Yahweh, of course. Now, need I remind you, brothers and sisters, that Cyrus overcame Babylon by drying up the Euphrates, making the frogs croak, and the two leaf gates were open, and he destroyed the cardinals of Babylon? Need I remind you of that? And in Revelation 16, verse 12, it says that the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the waters thereof were dried up, that the way of the kings who are out of the sun's rising. You know what Cyrus means, at least to the Persians? His name means the sun. But in the Hebrew, it means one like to the heir of the throne. He was raised up in righteousness. And the frogs croaked and are still croaking. And then came Armageddon. What follows then? The pouring out of the seventh vial upon Babylon the Great. And when Babylon's system is destroyed and Yahweh's perfected his work, he began with one and he ends with a multitude. What it says in verse 4. Who hath wrought and done it? It is done! We're looking at the fulfillment of that verse, aren't we? Calling the generations from the head. I, Yahweh, the first one, Christ. And with the last ones, the saints. I am he. The isles saw it. That's the Gentiles. And feared. The ends of the earth were afraid. They drew near and came. Because you see, they're all going to be part of that one great nation. Who is it? Verse 8. But thou, Israel, art my servant. Jacob, whom I have chosen. The seed of Abraham, my friend. Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof. I'll not cast thee away. You want to read on? Verse 14. Ye men of Israel, I will help thee, saith Yahweh, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. He calls himself that again at the end of verse 16. the Holy One of Israel. Have a look at the end of verse 20. The Holy One of Israel hath created it. I make all things new. Have a look at Isaiah 44. What's this context about? It's about developing a seed, isn't it? Verse 2. Yahweh that made thee and formed thee from the womb, which will help thee, fear not, O Jacob my servant, and thou, Jeshurun, the upright one whom I have chosen, for I will pour water upon him that is thirsty. Any bells ringing, brethren and sisters? He that is athirst, I will give him to drink of the water of life. Really? Bells ringing? Have a look at verse 5. And one shall say, I am Yahweh's, and another shall call himself by the name of Jacob, and another shall subscribe with his hand unto Yahweh and surname himself by the name of Israel. Oh yes. What other name? Thus saith Yahweh, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts, I the first one, and I the last one. Singular. And without me, no mighty ones. And who as I shall call and shall declare it and set it in order for me, since I appointed the people of the hidden period. That's what the word ancient is, it's Olam. And the things that are coming and that shall come, let them show them. Let them show unto them what things are coming. Verse 23. Sing, O ye heavens, for Yahweh hath done it. Shout, ye lower parts of the earth, break forth into singing, ye mountains, O forest, and every tree therein. Trees are a symbol of nations, aren't they? And of righteous people. For Yahweh hath redeemed Jacob and glorified himself in Israel. Thus saith Yahweh thy Redeemer, and he that formed thee from the womb, I am Yahweh that maketh all things. I make all things new. Need I go on, brethren and sisters? We could go on through Isaiah all day and all night and pick these ideas up which flow through the apocalypse like a mighty stream. But that'll do. What we need to do is to come back to Revelation 21 and wipe some tears away from our faces, brethren and sisters. For this sort of scene shall not be seen again. Now I know he's a Catholic. He's a Croatian. But they're burying his father. And he's 9 years old. God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. And there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying. Neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things have passed away. I make all things new. He said to me, it is done. He that overcometh shall inherit all things. And I will be his God, and he shall be my son. He'll be part of the Abrahamic corporation. Let the doctor have the last word on this, brethren and sisters. Have a look at this quotation from Eureka. Such is the consummation of the divine purpose in the creation of the heavens and the earth. He formed it to be inhabited, to be a tabernacle for himself with men. He could, had it pleased him, have created it perfect and filled with immortal inhabitants at the beginning. To have done this would have prevented all the crime and misery that blot and crimson the record of the past. But then the world would have been a characterless automaton and unfit for association with the governor of the universe, whose attributes are moral as well as intellectual and potential. He desired a society for our planet consisting of tried and faithful friends such as Abraham, who loved him better than his dearest son. He proposed to develop it upon the principle of belief in his promises and obedience under trial. Guess where the doctor's mind was when he was reading Revelation 21. And to crown the whole with incorruptibility in life, having prepared such a society as this and concentrated it from all ages and generations into one glorious community, he would then put his hand to the final completion of its dwelling place, as he declared to John, saying, "Behold, I make all things new." When these true and faithful words are fulfilled, it is done. Everything is finished by the Alpha Spirit, who began the work in the week of days, and as the Omega Spirit, the beginning and the end, completed it in a week of thousands of years. The invitation to participation in the sublime inheritance is liberal and worthy of deity, who said, "I will give to him that is thirsty of the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be deity to him. He shall be to me a son."
Thank you, Brother Jim.